accession number 28355, reel 7.
I'm sorry, the tape interrupted us. You were concluding what sounded like a discussion of the man management functions of a senior commander of a group.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that's what I certainly saw the job as, very much being tied up with knowing your people, being seen by them, getting around, and satisfying yourself that they were on top of the ball, on top of the game. So that was assistant chief of, that was AOC one group, and then I left there and went to vice chief of air staff in 1980, and this was, of course, my first introduction to being at Air Force board level. Chief Air Staff was Mike Beetham. I don't know, you've introduced Mike.
I've met Mike.
Yes, and he and I are now very good friends. But I think, had a good working relationship. And I, you know, the vice chief to the chief, certainly at the time I was working with Mike Beetham, you are very much the, you know, the sounding board and the, you know, one-on-one discussions about whatever is going on, and you know, that included the Falkland Islands in my time there. So, yeah. And when the chief of the air staff is away on leave or business, you take his place in the chief of staff meetings. So you've reached a totally different level of responsibility and outlook as a vice chief, as a member of the Air Force Board. You're beginning to have much more of a contact with ministers, although, again, I'm definitely going through a bit of amnesia. I was trying to remember who was around at that time.
Can I just pause here for a moment? Yes.
Than what we're trying to do now. And I was just talking to Patrick Wright at lunchtime, apropos of something totally different. But he was, he had written a limerick with a chap called Percy Craddock at the time of the Gulf War, when some of the mandarins weren't allowed to see some of the exchanges between the United States and ourselves because they were so highly classified or close to the chest. And Margaret Thatcher decided that, you know, just one member of each department. So, you know, Patrick had not nominated himself. He nominated Nigel Broomfield, and Percy Craddock was in the inside, and Michael Quinlan nominated Richard Mottram. And so Patrick had written this limerick about it. Was rather amusing, and I just happened to come across it digging out because he'd sent a copy of it to me about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've forgotten why. And I was telling him that, you know, I was doing this with you, and his thing was, how is the memory, you know, because he found he was extremely surprised to find at times when he got individuals coming to talk to him who had read up, you know, the Cuban missile crisis, and Patrick was in Washington then, and was totally surprised that Patrick knew nothing about it, or couldn't remember what day of the week anything had happened, let alone what had happened, and how often, you know, he'd actually found to his chagrin that he had invented something that had happened in his watch, which has nothing to do with what he realised later. So I think we're in danger of following down that line. And I really think that's a waste of everybody's, your time, my time, and any poor chap who has to delve through it. So I'm not anxious to prolong it when I really can't remember very much.
No, that's fine. what I'm trying to do is to ensure that this is your story to the extent that you now recall it and wish to put it on tape.
Yeah.
And I do recognise, of course, that you've gone through this once for the RAF at Hendon. Hopefully this will be the last time.
As far as I'm concerned, I have no intention of trying to repeat it. Unless I've gone completely gaga, I think I can recall all sorts of things that had happened in the past. So, there was just one thing, I think, in the ACOSOP thing, which might be of interest, and I don't know if you can just slot it in here. While
yes.
We're on tape now.
We're on now, yes.
Yeah. You may remember there was an Argentinian threat to the Falkland Islands in the Callaghan government when Michael Owen was
Foreign Secretary.
And there was a request to find out, you know, what we could do and what could we get down there. And so we had a look at this, and yes, you could get a Hercules with troops down there, but once the Hercules landed, there was no fuel there, and there was no way of getting it out, and probably with the length of the runway and a well-loaded Hercules, it wouldn't have got out anyway, so it wasn't a very satisfactory proposition, and eventually I think some submarines were sent, and that seemed to have done the trick at that particular time.
But of course you had to advise everybody that a submarine was going down there.
I was ACOSOPS then, so it wasn't my part of ship.
Yes.
You know, what the Navy were up to or being asked to do. I think I was aware that that was going to happen, but the detail of it and so on, I have no recollection. There was anxiety on the government's part. I mean, at that time in the mid 75s, one was saying, if you want to provide a force to protect the Falkland Islands, you've got to build a decent runway. And it wasn't until after we'd been invaded
that the runway was built.
Mount Pleasant was eventually built. And once you got Mount Pleasant, of course, you could guarantee to get there before the Argentinians coming by sea could get
yes.
there.
Or yes.
In sufficient quantity, anyway, to make it difficult for them. Provided you protected your airhead, which, of course, we continue to do this day. I think we've still got some tornadoes down there. But that was the key to the whole defence of the Falkland Islands. And the government of the day, in the mid-70s, didn't like the £30 billion or whatever it was bill that creating a runway would have amounted to. And, if they had, we wouldn't have had 1982 and all of that. So it's an interesting little snippet, I think. So
yes.
That's why I thought I ought to mention.
Thank you.
So that was that. Where were we? Vice chief.
Vice chief, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose one thing that did happen while I was vice chief was John Knott's defence review. Again, those who are sort of listening to this will have done plenty of work on John Knott's defence review. From the Air Force, of course, it was fairly favourable in that John Knott took the view that the defence of the UK base was of prime importance and the maritime side was not so important, and so the Navy faced the biggest potential cut. And of course, it was all rather ironic when we sort of rushed into the Falklands and needed every bit of shipping we could lay our hands on to do it. But the drive of the Knott review, he set out to do something which hadn't been done by ministers quite so clearly as he attempted to do, which was to sort of say, you know, this is what our defence policy is going to mean in terms of relative strengths between the services. The Air Force, with its defence of the United Kingdom, was meant that we kept, for example, our tornadoes and things, which could have been a threat if we decided that there was no airborne threat to the United Kingdom at that stage. Well, not important enough to defend ourselves against.
Was it seen that that the Air Force's principal role was defence of the UK or defence of our troops in Germany?
Well, I mean,
part of the same thing?
Yes, I mean, defence of the UK base and where we had troops overseas. Although there was some in the army who felt that they could rely on the Americans and others to provide the air protection, and we, the Royal Air Force, shouldn't be wasting our money on that. They could use the money much better on tanks or something like that. So I had a few battles with the army on that. I think actually even before that, while I was ACUS Ops, you know, it was an ongoing sort of perennial issue, inevitably when there isn't enough money and everybody's trying to squeeze something out for themselves out of somebody else's nice to haves as seen by them and essentials as seen by the owners. But you know, that's part of the normal cut and thrust, and it'll be going on to this day as it did long before I got involved in it. So that was that. So there was John Knott, the defence of the home base and reduction of the maritime capability, and the Tornado program attack and building up the F-3s. The other thing, I think, while I was vice chief, which part of the Falklands conflict, which we can come back to in a moment, was the Royal Air Force, United States Air Force Air Staff talks. I don't know how long they've been going on for, but the vice chiefs of the vice chief of staff, United States Air Force and VCAS on our side, met regularly, either in one country or the other. You know, it was, I can't remember the frequency, but it was certainly annually. It might even be more frequent than that. And it provides a very good sounding board for the two air forces to keep in step.
Yes, do continue. Right, I'm just checking here. I'm going to stop for a second.
Air staff to air staff talks at the vice chief level.
That's right.
I mean, really, since the Second World War, the close association between the two countries' air forces, originally Army Air Force in the case of the United States, but the two air forces, had been cemented by personal relationships. For example, you can think of Commander-in-Chief Strategic Air Command and various commanders in Chief Bomber Command, and at the Vice Chief level. Clearly, the Chiefs of Air Staff also met from time to time, but this was a very valuable way of keeping in step and understanding what each other was thinking about, talking about various things where we had mutual interests, filing deals or so on.
Yes,
I can't remember any of the particular details, but it always struck me as one of the most valuable ongoing, you know, relationships, and it was perpetuated for new incumbents on both sides, and you just went on, and I don't know if it still goes on to this day, it may do, but it certainly, in those days, particularly when we were sort of facing a common enemy, we had the same sort of approach on nuclear policies and so on, and the value of the UK base to the Americans' own strategic posture, whether it was filing deals at one end of it or forward basing of aircraft on the other. So that was, I think, a very important and a very useful arrangement, which happily in my time I thoroughly enjoyed, and kept in touch for many years after, in fact, with my opposite number, General Mathis.
Can I just ask, to what extent did the Americans do this with the other principal NATO allies, if at all, and to what extent did you do?
Nothing like, I think, in both cases. Certainly, I don't recall as the vice chief having much to do with the French or the Germans. I did as CAS, but it was peculiar, really, to the, as far as I can recall anyway, to the RAF, United States Air Force relationship. And very much on a bilateral basis, I don't think there was any sort of bar as to what one discussed or how one discussed it. It was extremely useful. The only other thing I think, while going by vice chief, of course, was the Falklands conflict in 1982, where clearly Michael Beetham, the CAS, was the main proponent, but if he was away or something, I was on the chief's in his place. And I did a fair bit of work on a variety of, not sort of supreme importance, but I thought extremely media important issues. One of the things that really got up my nose, and I'm sure other people, was that media coverage, particularly television, constantly showed what was happening as seen from the Argentinian end of the telescope. And certainly all the time our fleet was at sea before it got to the Falklands, there was some voice reporting but no pictures, and it was very one-sided. And we also had a policy which I instinctively disagreed, and you may remember, was it Gus MacDonald?
I remember
him well, Mr.
Yes,
Doo.
Yes, I do.
What was his name? Mac? Anyway. His instruction was, in brief, was that everything that had happened adversely had to be reported. So if a Harrier fell off the deck of Invincible, we told the world that a Harrier had fallen off. And you couldn't top up with Harriers. You know, you were just telling the opposition you were down one. And you were losing. That seemed to me very unfair from the point of view of those who are actually out in theatre. But it was deemed to, it was thought or argued that if you weren't honest with the public, then they wouldn't believe a thing you said. So, but I think, you know, there's a balance to be struck on that, and I don't think we got it right on that particular occasion. And in order to try and overcome it, I got a lot of work done fairly quick time to see if we could snatch film. We had broadband from northward out to the fleet, but that was purely for military use. And in those days, there were no satcoms or not sufficient to get pictures back. You get voice back, but you couldn't get pictures. They didn't have the bandwidth. It was impossible to use, or it wasn't thought right to use the military broadband, which needed to be kept open entirely for military purposes, to get any what I call newsworthy media, shots of the chaps training or getting ready, or generally sort of giving the great British public a feeling that something was really happening in a positive way. And so we tried to devise schemes where you could snatch with a Hercules and a grappling iron from, you know, two floating boys in a while, real sort of Heath Robinson stuff, to get it back to Ascension Island from where, of course, it could be transmitted back. And we never really made that. The other thing which I did find quite amusing and beneficial was from the fact when it was getting so much Argentinian footage, and you get pictures from the cockpit of an Argentinian aircraft landing at Port Stanley. And that was extremely valuable because you could see that they had not extended the runway. You could see the runway thresholds as you came in. And that was, of course, a great relief because it meant that they weren't going to be operating from the island. They would be operating from the mainland at the extreme limit of the A4 ranges and the Etonda, Super Etonda. So that was a great relief, and so there was some value in this wretched material, but I did feel it was very unbalanced. And it certainly struck me again when we came to my experience of the Gulf War. You needed your spokesman to be up to speed, but to have live mics, and going forward in time a moment, in Riyadh, in Washington, and in London, all being asked, the spokesman being asked the same question, and trying to make sure that one wasn't being giving a totally 180 degree answer to the other. So media management, if you can call it that, is terribly important. And that certainly was brought home to me in the Falklands, just how I'd never thought about it in terms of a sort of conflict before, and I think it struck us all.
So there were lessons which you carried forward.
Oh, yes.
You'll eventually see them.
Yes.
10 years later.
Yes, yes. And we're still learning, this time round from the last time. I still don't think we've got it absolutely right. There's that terrible balance to be struck between trying to be honest and upfront with the public, bearing in mind that there are an awful lot of media outlets now. None of them want to be controlled, and even those that are favourable are up against opposition who are uncontrollable in every sense. And if they reveal constantly intelligence information which could be valuable to the enemy, just where do you draw the line? I mean, it's extremely difficult, and I think, you know, you've got to be very aware of it and do as much thinking and planning about it beforehand, so that you've got your spokesman identified and well trained and media savvy. I mean, I think Brian Barrett did very well, for example, in the last Gulf War, but he was streets ahead of what we managed before.
Yes.
Now that may be just his personality, which was good at it. But it was also, I think, no doubt, because he learned a lot from the mistakes which all of us have been making in times past. So that's an ongoing issue, I think, and it was interesting how it really struck me in that Falklands period. And I think it's, you know, it's an area for study for anyone who's interested in striking a balance in a democracy between looking after the security interests of those who are actually fighting for you and the support of the public, without which, you know, those fighting aren't going to be very happy. You know, so trying to, and without doing it all by complete propaganda.
Yeah.
So that was that. Then if we could move on.
Yes.
I was vice chief from May 80 till September 82, and then I went to High Wycombe as AOC&C strike and Commander-in-Chief UK Air Forces, the NATO job, with responsibility for all the RAF operational for Air Force except for RAF Germany, which still had its own commander. Out of that, if I could take the Sync UK Air aspect first, that brought me into regular contact with SACAIR, who held quarterly meetings with the commanders-in-chief of the Northern Region, Central, Sync South, and yours truly as Sync UK Air. And it was, I had an enormous admiration for the way in which Bernie ran us as SACAIR. I mean, he was a very, very erudite character, very well regarded, and was in the job for a very long time. And I learned a lot from Bernie about sort of the NATO picture. Of course, one bumped in a great... Sorry, I'm playing with the...
No, that's okay. You're still connected.
So that was, you know, an aspect of my service career, which was sort of without the Air Force, because, I was representing UK Air Forces, but I was very much in the NATO environment. Which I enjoyed. I think there's a lot of rubbish talked about NATO, but I think for the period of the Cold War it was enormously valuable arrangement, and Bernie Rogers was an absolutely first-class SACAIR. We're still in touch, Bernie and I, and our wives. Although he's a bit frail now. Again, you know, what did we discuss? Well, I just can't recall, you know, in a way that would make any sense. One of the things which the Americans had been very keen on as a result of the experience in the Vietnam War was how frequently aircrew got shot down or lost out in the first 10 sorties or so on. After that, they began to get if they survived the first 10, they had every likelihood that their survival rates would go up increasingly. And the United States Air Force then devised the concept of red flags, which was peacetime training in as realistic a manner as you could for wartime operations. And they set this up for themselves. And I and others were extremely keen that we should get alongside this and be able to send squadrons out or small detachments out to participate. And after a slow beginning, that really took off. And it's been, as far as I know, it still goes on or something like it. And it is extraordinarily valuable because it was a two-way street, although initially the Americans, both in terms of quantity and the mere sort of mass of their air force, really sort of could run rings around you in terms of quantity. But in quality they couldn't, and I think there was very much a mutual exchange on that. And then the Americans brought in green flag, which was really red flag with electronics, jamming and all the rest of the electronic countermeasures, which was a more realistic regime than just the pure, what you might call, airspace management and operations. And there again, thanks to one's good contacts with the Americans at senior level over the years, I was able to approach SINCTAC and say, I was sitting with a coach, I forgot where we were going from, I think it was probably on an Air Chiefs tour, sitting next to him, and I said, you know, it'd be jolly good if we could get in on green flag, how about it? And in due course, yes, we got in. I think, you know, we the RAF had sort of done well on the red flags, and they were happy to bring us in on the green flags. And that sort of cooperation, I think probably red flag and maybe even green flag now is more widely drawn, but in those sort of relatively early days of working it up and experimenting with it, it was great to be alongside that, and I think it gave us an enormous amount of experience. I mean, all before expeditionary warfare, you know, the Cold War, none of us, no airman was getting any experience of real operations, or very, very little. And, you know, you could go, as I've said myself, you know, from end to end of your 40-year career, only once having been fired in anger, and that was by the IRA. In Downing Street. So nowadays, of course, the youngest air crew has probably had his tour out in Iraq or Kosovo or Afghanistan, and is a totally more blooded individual as a result than any of my generation, or people sort of below me at that stage, had been. So the red flags and the green flags, there's no substitute for the real thing, but they were a very, very good training aid, and I was extremely glad that we were able to get alongside the Americans on that, and I attached a lot of importance to that. Of all ones, sort of little things where you can put a tick in the box, getting in particularly into green flag, I think, was one that I felt we'd done the right thing. I mentioned the Central Region Chiefs Conferences we used to go on tours together. And again, you met all the NATO chiefs that way, even before you were a chief yourself. So it was quite nice that when I became CAS, I already knew quite a number of my colleagues from this particular exposure. So that was valuable. Otherwise, I don't think there's much I want to say about Strike. It was a big empire, inevitably.
Did the command work well?
Yes. Oh, yes. I was very lucky. I had good group commanders. I had a good deputy and a good SASO. You know, Strike Command inevitably collected
And you're an air marshal.
I'm an air chief marshal. I became an air chief marshal, I think acting, when I went in September and presumably in January 83 on the Air Force list. I can't remember, but I would guess.
Yes. Yeah.
So that was that. Then CAS in October 85, Heseltine, reorganization, reduced the air staff, it says here. And Heseltine was not everybody's cup of tea, and certainly not mine. He got many fine attributes, but his concept of organization, you can't pull a hierarchical organization up by the roots and splatter it all around and expect it to carry on as though nothing had happened. It took a lot of us, you know, we all had to say what we were doing right down to junior levels, and I can't remember all the management jargon, there's an awful lot of it. It did lead to a reduction in some of the headquarters staffs, and in principle, you know, I've got no great difficulty with that. Your air forces, your armed forces are reducing. You've got to take at least as much, if not more, out of the headquarters, otherwise the thing just ends up.